I am here in the studio with Black Twig Pickers, who are in town to do a show. This is being recorded on September 15th, Saturday afternoon, a beautiful day here in Jersey City. Band members consisting of Mike Gangloff, Isaac Howell, Nathan Bowles, and Sally Morgan. And that was a fantastic set of music. You guys sounded terrific. So we're going to... How are those mics sounding? Can you? I'm not getting much here. Vocal mics.
How about this?
Here a little bit.
They sing louder
check,
than
check,
they
check.
Talk.
Check, 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 check.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and this one over here. Yep.
That sounds all right.
All right. How about this microphone?
Okay.
I hope that's not going to go on with on air.
No, no, no. The editing team will whip into action.
Crack editing team.
Consisting of me. So the Black Twig Pickers take their name from a type of apple that was introduced into Virginia, where the band originated. And so I'm also guessing that you grew up with this music. Is that, am I presuming, or is that... Is that the music you grew up with, or there was just all sorts of music around?
I think we all grew up with different kinds of music. I think, like most people, we're not too far away from this, families and stuff like that. But I grew up mostly in church music, and then later, you know, discovered the Velvet Underground and stuff like that. But I don't know, Sally, you may have been more into this younger than the rest of us. I don't know.
I mean, I started listening to bluegrass music in high school, but I didn't really grow up with it. It was more of a something I thought was cool for some reason.
That's part of the reason that I ask those sort of questions, because it seems like every teenage kid wants to run off and become the next Velvet Underground. So for somebody to pick up a banjo or a fiddle seems not the first choice.
Are you trying to say this is not going to work? We're Velvet Underground, and this is our plan. This is Plan A.
Oh, sorry,
it's
not.
Cut his mic off.
Well, I think you're saying that you're going to become a rock band at the end of this tour. You're done with the old timey stuff.
This is the rock.
This is the rock band.
This is the rock music of Virginia.
Yeah. Right. Correct.
Yeah. You know, when we heard those Velvet Underground records, somehow we got turned into the viola, and then it back into Tony Conrad, and it just led us right back to fiddle music.
All right. Okay. You went back through the avant-garde thing. You know, some of you guys would play with the Spiral Joy Band.
The Spiral Joy Band, and some of us play in Pelt and have for a long time. We've played the dronier improvisational music and still do.
Yeah. 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 I know those bands are both still active now. A lot of bands don't stay together for as long as you guys do. I know that, Sally, you're a relative newcomer to the band, but 10 or 12 years are going on?
Yeah, I guess the Twigs have been around, what, 13 years, Isaac?
13 years.
Yeah, Mike and I started playing in 99, so.
Nathan's been on board.
Since about 2006.
And Sally...
About 2 years ago, I started playing.
As soon as she was old enough to drink, we brought her into the band.
Do the various other bands, the side projects, like the Spiral Joy Band and Pelt, does that actually help because you go off and do something else and then come back here? Does it sort of
it all informs
revive
each other,
you?
I think. I mean, sure. They're both disciplined musics, I guess. I find there's a lot of cross-pollination in the way I think.
Yeah, Sally, just a couple weeks ago up in Madison, Wisconsin, sat in for a Pelt song, and it may have been your first kind of improvisational outing, at least, of that nature. What did you think about it?
Yeah, it was my first time doing that, and it felt really natural to me, even though I hadn't really done it before, and I think...
Just vocal improvisation.
Oh no, just with fiddle. I was just playing the fiddle.
Oh, okay.
But you know, there were all sorts of other instruments involved.
Yeah, we're playing a song that had two fiddles and a viola and harmonium and a piano, and it's all based around this this particular scale and you know, improvisation within that. And I think playing that kind of music.
Yeah, hang on a second, because right. we're gonna have to. It's a little. So, Sal, you should probably say that section over about you playing fiddle with Pelt.
I played fiddle on one long improvisational set with Pelt a few weeks ago, and that was my first time doing that, but it felt really natural at the time, and I think it has to do with... I mean, the music, old time, isn't that different from droney improv stuff. Like, you can still get into the same sort of groove where you're doing the same thing for like 20 minutes and you kind of lose yourself in it. So
yeah, both old time and the sort of improv that we do, I think, has a dervish kind of quality to it.
And I think after you play free music for a while or you listen to it, your ears change a little bit and you start to hear different things in other musics as well. And
that's,
I think,
true.
We tend to gravitate toward the dronier, dervish-ier side of the old-time stuff, too.
Yeah, I guess it might seem unusual to a listener of old-time music, because we tend to think back to the early recordings of the 1920s, where you had to keep it below 3 minutes, and then we think of a drone recording of a band on stage and maybe playing for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes or whatever. So it seems incongruous, but to you guys, it isn't at all.
Yeah, the master musicians of Mount Airy. So it's exactly what you're saying is what Patrick from Pelt suggested to us a year or whatever at some point along the way. He said, you know, you guys, these songs need to go on much longer. And we just did a record where we tried to experiment with that idea. We have a record called Wompy Jaw that came out on Thrill Jockey recently this summer. And it just has one song on each side. And it was an attempt to sort of
merge
translate,
those two things.
Yeah, translate into the recording process what happens in living rooms and front porches and back porches and so on all the time, which is just this long cyclical jam. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That hopefully kind of takes on this energy that either chases people far, far away, just keeps them going.
It is a 45, so it's not quite like, you know, 22 minutes of
That's the next one.
But it is, I mean, it's very natural for us to get in a groove just playing around or at a show, especially if we're playing for dancers, to just, you know, play for, 10, 12 minutes is not unusual. So it felt pretty natural to do that on the record and have some friends of ours dancing, doing some flat footing that was so rhythmically, like, connected to the dance scene. I mean, the music is so tied up in that dance rhythm, flat foot rhythm, so it's really cool to get a recording of that happening at the same time and have it mic'd well. And
Stu will appreciate the challenges of mic'ing a whole gang of flat footers and trying to impose some clarity on it.
I haven't heard that term flat footing before, but it puts me in mind of the Irish Sean Nose dancers. Is it step dancing?
Well, it's more, Sally can probably answer that better. Yes.
It is very similar. You're just making percussion noises with your feet. It's like clogging. There's a lot of clogging teams, except flat footing's the more just old school, like one person doing it, not making fancy moves, just sort of tapping along with their feet.
Yeah.
A little more improvised.
It's
and individual.
More improvisational, I think. Yeah.
It's also called buck dancing.
Sometimes. In the Celtic tradition, which is probably where it came from originally, the old style, which is not so much practiced today, the feet stay pretty close to the floor, and it does have a very percussive element. And I think they do improv off it also based on, you know, what the fiddler might be doing or the piano player. I'm thinking of Kep Breton music.
Yeah.
So very often it's just fiddle and piano.
And like a lot of these things, there probably aren't hard and fast definitions. There's a friend of ours who's a very good dancer, Barbara Bowman, who talks, you know, she has her own definitions for these things, and she talks about cloggers dancing every other beat of a fiddle tune and flat footers dancing every beat, every note. But
again, you've talked about the connection between drone and the dance music. So if you think about now I'm putting myself in mind of a dance set where you would literally just string one tune after the other. So it doesn't seem so unusual because you playing a 3-minute tune or 2-minute tune, and before you know it, you've played 20 minutes yep. without a break, and everyone's, you know, dancing in yeah. in a circle. Or
and we tend to just, it's usually, we don't usually, we occasionally medley tunes, but it's usually just, I mean, so many old-time tunes are like an A part, a B part, maybe a C part, and you just keep going around and around, and you end the song when you feel like ending it. So we'll just cycle on a tune for, yeah, as long as
and
it
needs to go.
And just
try to dig in and dig in and dig in.
Yeah, right, kind of make it so that it's interesting for us and the people listening. You could dancing, yeah, I mean, you get that ecstatic sort of those waves, you know. You want the music to have these plateaus of energy, you know, and you want to keep the energy going. So that's the challenge of, I guess, playing music for dancers and keeping it interesting when you're playing that along. But that's a fun challenge, I think. I mean, it keeps me and us, I think, interested in playing that kind of music.
Yeah, maybe it happens less so in old-timey versus Celtic, because it seems like coming out of the Irish and Scotch tradition, which is where your music comes from, the old-timey Americana, you have very often you'll start out with a slow air or an air, and in the Scots music there'll be a strathspey or a reel, a jig, a hornpipe, so it'll all be dance music, but it'll be different speeds. You seem like you're playing more of a single tune.
It's just a long tune. Yeah, I mean, it's just a tune. The tune could be 2 minutes long or 12 minutes long. I mean, you know, it's the same melody. We just cycle through the melody and try and keep it
kind of pull it this way, pull it that way.
Right.
Where it's going to go that night.
It's not preset. I mean, if it feels good for 9 minutes,
just
we
keep,
might
keep,
play it for 9 minutes.
Yeah.
If it's starting to feel bad after 3 minutes, we might
pull the plug on it.
Something else.
Yeah.
Play a waltz next, a two-step next, and so, you know, keep it varied. But we're not very good at keeping things under 3 minutes.
That's all right.
And we play the dance songs as long as it feels right, and often it starts, you know, feeling really right only several minutes in.
Yeah,
that's true.
Get the melody up under your skin, and the dancers start to feel it. And for some reason, even though it's the same melody you've been hearing for 4 minutes, it sounds great, and the dancers feel it, and it's just getting better. And you just hold on.
Malcolm Gladwell calls the tipping point, right?
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
So there's been such a big deal made about the folk revival and when it started, and so in your minds, is what you're doing the same as they were doing in the 1920s, or do you? In your ears, this is an update of it? This is different, what makes it different if it is? Does it to you? It's like when you listen to the old pre-war country music or old timey or whatever happens to be, and the music you're doing today. Does that seem the same or a different version of it? Is that clear?
The question's clear. I mean, you know, we're people playing music in a room just like the people on those records were people playing music in a room. I mean, I don't...
In some of the old-time music, the musicians seem to make sometimes a distinction, and I don't know if you do in this type of music. I know when maybe in Irish and Scots music, it sounds different. The older pre-war stuff sounds different.
Sure. I mean,
and we're not
so
trying
reasons.
To replicate that.
Yeah,
no, we're not trying to sound like music that already happened or copy another thing or pretend to be in the 1920s. We're trying to play music now, and we think if you get personally involved in it, and then you'll be making good music. But we don't feel like we're replicating it, or it's not about. It's not like museum music, I think. But I mean, it is a tradition. We feel like we're part of it, but we're also not trying to just replicate some pre-war.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I don't think it's a tradition that really needs a whole lot of reviving. I think that the tradition has just continued along, and it's been more in the public eye and less in the public eyes.
I guess that's maybe what it is. Yeah.
But there's plenty of people that we know personally whose families have played this music and whose communities have played this music going, you know, back to the pre-war era and long
before
and the pre-war before that, you know. But so I think there's a couple points in there, but one is that we're definitely, as Isaac says, we think we're playing our own music within this tradition, and we're playing within this tradition because the tradition just appeals to us. It calls to us. We like what we hear in it. And so we're trying to find our own spot within it, which means that we sort of surrender to the tradition at one level, but on the other hand, we can never surrender our own voice, because then we'll just sound like we're, you know, some sort of museum thing.
And I think that's another...
We're not reenactors.
Well, you definitely don't sound like reenactors or anything like that.
I think
by
that's
any
another connection with the drone music, too, is both those, the disciplines of, like, and traditions of old time and free improv or whatever you want to call that. It's, they both are very good places for personal expression. Like, I find old time music to be just, it's incredibly satisfying and nourishing to me to, like, find your personal voice within these songs that, you know, you'll find a bunch of people playing, but everyone's putting, you know, giving it their own voice.
Right, even in terms of a fiddle player, just, you can just add a little grace note on the end of something, or just go heavier on the bow, or draw out the note longer, and it changes the thing dramatically and makes it your own music. However, again, I have, my background is from Cape Breton. My mother's from there, so I have a deep connection to that music. I've heard, you know, so much of it, and all those great fiddlers, of which there are many, they all have a little, you know, add a little thing here or a little there. So I think that's
of course, yeah. I mean,
they all have a little different voice on it.
Yeah. So the music that comes into the mix with you guys, is it stuff that you find on records, or how much of it is like, oh, you run across, you mentioned a musician earlier, Coolidge Winesap. Now that's an old timey fiddler name if ever I heard one.
Yeah.
And there's an Apple connection there as well. So,
Winesap, actually, not Winesap, but yeah.
So, how much of the music comes from people, whether it's from your family or people that you meet on the road, that, oh, you have to hear this, or how much of it comes from the recordings, old or new or whatever?
We try to keep a kind of local focus to the area right around where we live. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of, we kind of define it pretty broadly. Isaac is living in West Virginia now, hour and a half, 2 hours north of where Nathan and Sally and I are living. We're still in Virginia, but so we're kind of that West Virginia going into Southwest Virginia, going down to the North Carolina line sort of region. We've really sort of tried to study the tunes and know the players of that area, and we draw a lot on that repertoire. And
yeah, because there are tunes that seem to be indigenous to certain area,
totally.
And you'll go 200 miles and
sure.
they and
they're, oh, you can go
2 miles.
2 miles. I mean, it's so specific. Miles, you meet, it's so geographical. It's kind of mind blowing when you get into it. The variations of tune flavors, just
and in songs too, you find people, song collectors, that'll go and they'll literally find one person that's singing this song that was first noted 250 years ago and no one's made a recording of it ever,
right?
So that's kind of miraculous to me.
We just find that fascinating, and why a tune would hang on in this one particular tiny locale, you know. It seems to be keyed to the geography, or, you know, you just wonder why does it persist
or like
in this particular place.
That version of Ebenezer we played is not, you know, that's a pretty particular
it's different
way
than
of
the
playing
way
it.
It's usually played in the fiddle circles, and it was just the way Coolidge had come into playing it.
Hmm.
And
if you think of the Watson family or the Ritchie family,
exactly,
and they have, they keep the tradition alive just by passing it along.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's everybody goes over to the Watson house or the Ritchie house, and then that's how it passes along down to you guys.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, I think we do learn a lot from recordings.
Yeah, we love recording. A lot of, there's so many, the internet, too, has been amazing for, like, archives of field recordings and home recordings of people who'd never made, you know, records per se, but had someone stick a microphone on them at some point. And we do listen to a lot of so many recordings of.
It's amazing how much stuff is out there.
It's pretty, yeah. Mike is kind of the in the band, the curator of a ton of whole lot of field recording stuff.
I mean, it's weeks and just months and years of stuff to listen to that was just recorded in people's living rooms or places like that. That there's no commercial intent to it. It was just strictly documentation that somebody did. I've been listening a lot lately to a recording of a fiddler and banjo player named Sam McNeil, who lived pretty near where I live. I guess he lived from the late 1800s, died in the sort of mid 1980s. And these recordings I'm listening to were made by his daughters, and just for the family.
No commercial recordings of these?
He recorded some in the 78 era. He was in a band called the Floyd County Ramblers with his brother, and those records are kind of known out there. But those records were made, in about 1929, 1930?
Yeah, sounds about right.
And they had such a horrible time coming up here to New York to record. There was a traffic accident, and Sam's brother Banks McNeil was laid up in the hospital for a couple weeks.
That's an old-timey name, Banks.
Banks McNeil. Banks, yeah. But when their records sold well enough that they were invited back, they said no thanks. that was the end of their recording career commercially. But Sam recorded through the rest of his life, and I found some of them in libraries, and then got to know one of his daughters a little bit in particular, and talked to some of the daughters-in-law, and just, was looking for family members and trying to find out a little more about Sam and about his tunes, and they were gracious enough to share with me a couple CDRs worth of recordings they had made
in the
70s and 80s. And
that's great to get stuff like
that. Yeah, just wonderful things like that are there to be found and looked into, and I think taken very seriously and loved and hopefully passed on a little bit so that somebody else will keep playing these things.
Now, you guys at one point did a recording with Charlie Parr. How did you guys cross paths, you and Charlie?
That was through Mike, I guess.
Yeah, it was a kind of a complicated chain of emails, basically, but Charlie had heard a couple of the first Black Twig records, and a friend of his turned us onto his records that we thought were just fantastic, and eventually we encountered him, and we played some shows together, and then that led to starting to actually, instead of taking turns playing on stage, just all climb up there and charge through the songs, and that eventually led to that gospel record. Charlie was in a big gospel phase at the moment and was just playing all these great old gospel songs, and he showed us enough of them to record a record's worth.
And that loops back to where you started with, you said, church music.
It does. I might still be in it if the music had sounded like what Charlie was singing and playing.
I guess, right. Yeah, he's pretty fantastic. And you guys played with the late, great Jack Rose.
Yeah.
An amazing musician.
Yeah, we miss Jack a lot. I'd known Jack in Pelt for years and years, and lived with him in Richmond for a little while, and just had known him for a long time, and it was after he'd gone so far in the guitar world, he sort of got us playing with him a little bit, and that was wonderful. We made that record and some 7-inches, and Nathan and I went on a tour in England with him just before he passed, and I'm glad that we got to do that.
People seem to be very respectful of American musicians over in Europe, and so I'm guessing you had a similar experience. It seems like they're quiet, and you playing in clubs over there or concert halls, or how does
it's a mix. There's anything from a rock club to a bar to a bit more sit down polite concerty hall
to the Cecil
Sharp House.
Okay,
that was the last night we saw Jack. That was the last gig of the tour. Mike and Jack and I that room was crazy. It sounded so good, and it was just such a beautiful building, and that was an amazing night. That was incredible.
But I think the my limited experience in Europe is that the audiences tend to be a bit more respectful of, knowledgeable, just into the sort of art experience. People want to come out and see some art, and whether that art is a noisy rock band or some string music or something else entirely, it's what they're looking for. And I think there's probably some cultural thing, and maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, I think that's totally right.
But we've been treated very, very well in Europe.
That seems to be a common experience. You go to a club, in an area, even in Brooklyn, where you think people would be quiet and listen to the band, and it doesn't seem to be the case at all. They seem very happy. At least half the audience, if I can use that term, audience, seems to be happy enough to talk through the music.
Yeah,
it's sort of weird to me.
Sally went with us for the first time in July on a week in England.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Did you find the audience as much different? Than
I did, but I also, most of our gigs over here are either at bars or at the Floyd Country Store or at a square dance. You know, there aren't really sit-down venues that
we play
at.
Yeah, that's true. Or it's like they're sitting down, but they're like eating spaghetti and pizza. Yeah. I mean, like they're not, you know.
We play the sit-down concerts some, but it's a lot less often. The vast majority of our shows are more throw-down kind of atmosphere.
Which is probably what you're more comfortable with, I'm guessing.
Well, it would be...
They're both good. I mean, they're different.
It's kind of nice to have people like sitting and quietly listening to you sometimes.
As a musician, it's nice when people listen. But
yeah, I would think. Yeah.
But, you know, they're gonna bring their own truth to this music. So
you guys are doing a couple of dates here in New York. Tonight for the Thrill Jockey 20th anniversary. This is going to be aired on October 20th. So you're just doing these two dates with the Thrill Jockey Records.
Yeah,
on this trip, yeah.
Heading back home.
Yep.
And then so Thrill Jockey is working out for you guys. You used to be on VHF.
Yeah, we're still. Yeah, yeah.
And we're still real good friends with Bill Kellerman, who runs VHF. But the Thrill Jockey has worked out. It's a funny label to be on, playing the kind of music we play. But they treat us really well, and it does seem to get the music out to unexpected corners where it might not get otherwise. And we know that because people contact us and ask us to come play them, or you know, just get in touch. And it's working really well so far.
That's great. You have some, at least. I think it's important if you have somebody at the label who champions you and pushes you out there. And
I think with Thrill Jockey, my impression is that Bettina kind of champions everybody that's on that label. She's really amazing with what she does there.
So. Well, that's good. That's really glad. That's really great to hear. I see from the infamous clock on the wall here that we're out of time today. So I want to thank my engineer, Stu Rutherford, who did yeoman's work today. We had him working his wheels off today. So thank you, Stu, and thank you to the Black Twig Biggers who were kind enough to journey out to Jersey City and lay down some beautiful music for us today. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeff. We've had a great time.
All right, thanks.